Mallory edged forward, matching his stride with that of the Marquis of Hastings. "What's in this depot of yours, your lordship? A deal of fine loot, I should hope? A deal of fine hope, my looting friend? But never you mind that. Tell me this, Comrade Ned, what would you do with loot if you had it?"
"I suppose that might depend on what it was," Mallory ventured.
"You'd carry it back to your rat, Warren," the Marquis surmised, "and sell it for a fraction of its worth to a fencing Jew, and spend the lot of that on drink to wake in a day or two in a filthy station-house with a copper's foot on your neck." Mallory stroked his chin.
"What would you do with it, then?"
"Put it to use, of course. We shall use it in the cause of those who gave it value. By that I mean the common folk of London, the masses, the oppressed, the sweated labour, those who produce all the riches of this city."
"That's a queer sort of talk," Mallory said.
"The revolution does not loot, Comrade Ned. We sequester, we commandeer, we liberate. You and your friends were drawn here by a few imported gewgaws. You think to carry off what your hands can clutch in a few moments. Are you men or magpies? Why settle for a pocketful of dirty shillings? You could own London, the modern Babylon herself. You could own futurity."
"Futurity, eh?" said Mallory, glancing back at Fraser.
Above his gingham mask, the policeman's eyes showed unmitigated loathing. Mallory shrugged.
"How much tin will a quart of futurity fetch, your lordship?"
"I'll thank you not to call me that," the Marquis said sharply. "You address a veteran of popular revolution, a people's soldier who takes pride in the simple title of comrade.
Begging your pardon, I'm sure.
You're not a fool, Ned. You can't mistake me for a rad lord. I'm no bourgeois meritocrat. I'm a revolutionary, and a mortal enemy by blood and conviction of the Byron tyranny and all its works."
Mallory coughed harshly, cleared his throat.
"All right, then," he said in a new and sharper voice. "What's all this talk about? Seizing London? You can't be serious. That hasn't been done since William the Conqueror."
"Read your history, friend," the Marquis retorted. "Wat Tyler did it. Cromwell did it. Byron himself did it." He laughed.
"The people risen have seized New York City. The working people rule Manhattan as we walk and speak here. They have liquidated the rich. They have burned Trinity. They have seized the means of information and production. If mere Yankees can do that, then the people of England, far more advanced along the course of historical development, can do it with even greater ease."
It was clear to Mallory that the lad, for beneath that mask and swagger he was very young, believed this evil madness with a whole heart.
"But the government," Mallory protested, "will send in the army. Kill that officer class, and the army rank and file will rise with us," the Marquis said coolly. "Look at your soldier friend Brian there. He seems happy enough in our company, aren't you, Comrade Brian?"
Brian nodded mutely, waving a filth-smeared hand.
"You don't yet grasp the genius of our captain's strategy," the Marquis said. "We stand in the heart of the British capital, the one area on earth that Britain's imperial elite are unwilling to devastate in the pursuit of their evil hegemony. The rad lords will not shell and burn their own precious London to quell what they falsely think a period of passing unrest. But," he raised one gloved forefinger, "when we mount the barricades throughout this city, then they will have to struggle hand to hand with the aroused working class, men nerved to the marrow with the first true freedom they have ever known."
The Marquis stopped a moment, wheezing for breath at the fetid air.
"Most of the oppressor class," he continued, coughing, "have already fled London to escape the stink. When they attempt to return, the risen masses will meet them with fire and steel. We will fight them from the rooftops, from doorways, alleyways, sewers and rookeries." He paused to dab his nose with a snotty kerchief from his sleeve. "We will sequester every sinew of organized oppression, the newspapers, the telegraph lines, and pneumatic tubeways, the palaces and barracks and bureaus. We will put them all to the great cause of liberation."
Mallory waited, but it seemed that the young fanatic had at last run out of steam.
"And you want us to help you, eh? Join this people's army of yours?"
"Of course."
"What's in it for us, then?"
"Everything," the Marquis said. "Forever."
There were handsome ships moored inside the West India docks, tangled rigging and steamer stacks. The water within the docks, a byway from the sewage flow of the Thames, did not seem quite so foul to Mallory, until he saw, floating amid thin wads of slime, the bodies of dead men. Murdered sailors,
the skeleton crews that shipping lines left to guard their ships in harbour. The corpses floated like driftwood, a sight to chill the marrow. Mallory counted 15 bodies, possibly 16, as he followed the Marquis along the gantry-shrouded wooden dockway. Perhaps, he theorised, most of the crews had been killed elsewhere, or else recruited to swell the ranks of Swing's piracy. Not all sailors were loyal to order and authority. The Ballesta Molina pistol was a cold weight against Mallory's gut. The Marquis and his black led them blithely on. They passed a deserted ship where an ugly vapour, steam, or smoke curled up ominously from the hatches below decks. A quartet of anarchist guards, their carbines propped in a crude stack, played cards atop a barricade of bales of looted calico. Other guards, drunken, whiskered wretches in bad plug hats and worse trousers, armed derelicts, slept in toppled barrows and loading sledges, amid a swelling debris of barrels, baskets, hawser coils and loading ramps, heaps of black coal for the silenced steam derricks. From the warehouses across the water to the south came a ragged volley of distant popping gunshots. The Marquis showed no interest, did not break stride, did not even look.
"You overpowered all these ships?" Mallory inquired. "You must have a deal of men, Comrade Marquis."
"More by the hour," the Marquis assured him. "Our men are combing Limehouse, rousing every working family. Do you know the term exponential growth, Comrade Ned?"
"Why, no," Mallory lied.
"Mathematical clacking term," the Marquis lectured absently. "Very interesting field, engine clacking. No end of use in the scientific study of socialism." He seemed distracted now. Nervous. "Another day of stink like this, and we'll have more men than the London police force. You're not the first coves I've recruited, you know. I'm quite an old hand at it by now. Why, I wager even my man Jupiter could do it!" He slapped the shoulder of the negro's livery coat. The negro showed no reaction. Mallory wondered if he were deaf and dumb. He wore no breathing mask. Perhaps he did not need one. The Marquis led them to the greatest among a series of warehouses, even among the stellar names of commerce— Whitby's, Evan Hare, Aaron's, Madras and Pondicherry Company, this was a very palace of mercantile modernity. Its vast loading doors had risen on a clever system of jointed counterweights, revealing an interior of steel frame construction, with translucent plate glass vaulting a roof that stretched wide and long as a soccer green. Below this roof grew a maze of steel braces, a fretwork of ratchets and wheeled tracking where engine-driven pulley carts could run along like spiders. Somewhere pistons chugged with the familiar popping racket of an engine printing press. But the press was hidden somewhere behind a maze of booty to stupefy a Borgia. Merchandise lay in heaps, haystacks, mountains, brocades, lounge chairs, carriage wheels, epergnes and chandeliers, tureens, mattresses, iron lawn dogs and Parian bird baths. Billiard tables and liquor cabinets, bedsteads and stair newels, rolled rugs and marble mantelpieces.
"'Struth!' Tom cried. "'How did you do all this?'
"'We've been here for days now,' the Marquis said. He tugged the kerchief from his face, revealing a pale visage of almost girlish beauty, with a downy blonde moustache. "'There are goods in plenty still in the other go-downs, and you shall all have a chance for a turn at the sledge and barrow. It's grand fun. And it's yours, for it belongs to all of us equally.'
"'All of us?' Mallory said.
"'Of course, all the comrades.'
Mallory pointed at the negro.
"'What about him?' "'What, my man Jupiter?' the Marquis blinked. "'Jupiter belongs to all of us too, of course. He's not my servant alone, but the servant of the common good.'
The Marquis mopped his dripping nose on a kerchief.
"'Follow me!'
The heaping of booty had made a monster rat's nest of the warehouse's scientific storage plan. Following the Marquis, they picked their way across shoals of broken crystal, puddles of cooking oil, a crunchy alleyway littered with peanut hulls.
"'Odd,' the Marquis muttered. "'When last I was here, the comrades were all about the place.'
The heaps of goods dwindled toward the rear of the warehouse. They passed the whacking printing press, hidden from sight in a cul-de-sac of towering bundles of newsprint. Someone threw a bundle of wet printing bills over the barricade, almost striking the Marquis, who hopped deftly over it. Mallory became aware of a distant voice, high-pitched and shrill. At the very rear of the warehouse, a large section of floor space had been made into an impromptu lecture hall. A chalkboard, a table piled with glassware, and a lectern all sat unsteadily on a stage of close-packed soap crates.
Mismatched sets of cheap dining chairs in pressed oak and maple veneer served as seating for a silent audience of perhaps 80. "So here they are," said the Marquis, with an odd quaver in his voice. "You're in luck. Dr. Barton is favouring us with an exposition. Seat yourselves at once, comrades. You will, I assure you, find this well worth your attention." To his vast surprise, Mallory found himself and his companions forced to join the audience in the final row of chairs. The negro remained standing, hands clasped behind his back at the rear of the hall. Mallory, seated next to the Marquis, rubbed his smarting eyes in disbelief. "This speaker of yours is wearing a dress." "Hush!" the Marquis whispered urgently. The female lecturer, brandishing a chalk-tipped ebony pointer, was hectoring the seated crowd in a voice of shrill but closely measured fanaticism. The strange acoustics of the makeshift hall warped her words as if she were speaking through a drumhead. Some kind of queer temperance lecture, it seemed, for she was decrying the poison alcohol and its threat to the revolutionary spirit of the working class. She had flasks, great glass-stoppered carboys full of liquor on her table. They were labelled with a skull and crossbones, amid a truck of distillation flasks, red rubber tubing, wire cages, and laboratory gas rings. Tom, at Mallory's right, tapped Mallory's arm and whispered in a voice of near terror, "Ned, Ned! Is that Lady Ada?" "My God, boy," Mallory hissed, the hair prickling in fear all across his arms and neck. "What makes you think that? Of course it isn't she." Tom looked relieved, puzzled, vaguely offended. "Who is it, then?" The lecturing female turned to the chalkboard and wrote, in a ladylike cursive, the words, "Neurasthenic degeneracy." She turned, aimed a false and brilliant smile at the audience over her shoulder, and for the first time Mallory recognized her. She was Florence Russell Bartlett. Mallory stiffened in his chair with a half-stifled gasp of shock. Something, a fleck of dry cotton from within his mask, lodged like a barb in his throat. He began coughing, and he could not stop. His slimy throat was lacerated. He tried to smile, to whisper a word of apology, but his windpipe seemed pinched in iron bands. Mallory fought the racking spasms with all his strength, hot tears gushing freely, but he could not stop himself, nor even muffle the nightmare hacking. It called a deadly attention to him like a costermonger's bellow. At last Mallory jerked to his feet, knocking his chair back with a clatter and staggered away half-bent, half-blinded. He tottered, arms outstretched, through the blurry wilderness of booty, his feet tangling in something, some wooden object falling with a clatter. Somehow he found a spot of shelter and bent there shaking violently, his breath choked now by a loathsome bolus of phlegm and vomit. "I could die from this," he thought in desperation, his eyes bulging in their sockets. "Something will rupture. My heart will burst." Then somehow the clog was gone, the fit defeated. Mallory drew a ragged squeak of air, coughed, found his wind, and began to breathe. He wiped foul spittle from his beard with his bare hand and found himself leaning against a piece of statuary. It was a life-size Hindu maiden in Coates' patent artificial stone, half-nude, with a water jug poised on her draperied hip. The jug was solid stone, of course, though every atom in him cried out for a cleansing sip of water. Someone clapped him firmly on the back. He turned, expecting Tom or Brian, and found the Marquis there. "Are you quite all right?"
"A passing fit," Mallory croaked.
He waved one hand, unable to straighten. The Marquis slipped a curved silver flask into his hand.
"Here," he said, "this will help."
Mallory, expecting brandy, tilted the flask to his lips. A treacly concoction, tasting vaguely of licorice and elm, flooded his mouth. He swallowed reluctantly.
What is this?"
"One of Dr. Barton's herbal remedies," the Marquis told him, "a specific against the fetor.
Here, let me soak your mask in it. The fumes will clear your lungs." "I'd rather you didn't,"
Mallory rasped. "Are you fit, then, to return to the lecture?"
"No, no."
The Marquis looked sceptical. "Dr. Barton is a medical genius. She was the first woman ever to graduate with honours from Heidelberg. If you knew the wonders she's worked among the sick in France, the poor wretches given up for dead by the so-called experts."
"I know,"
Mallory blurted. Something like strength returned to him, and with it a strong urge to throttle the Marquis. shake this damned and dangerous little fool till the nonsense squeezed out of him like paste. He felt a suicidal urge to blurt out the truth, that he knew this Barton to be a poisoner, an adulteress, a vitrioleuse, wanted by police in at least 2 countries. He could whisper that confession, then kill the Marquis of Hastings and stuff his wretched body under something. The fit left him, replaced with a rational, cunning, cold and brittle as ice.
"I should rather talk with you, comrade," said Mallory, "than listen to any lecture."
"Really?" said Hastings, brightening. Mallory nodded earnestly.
I find I always profit by listening to a man who truly knows his business.
I cannot make you out, comrade, the Marquis said. Sometimes you seem to me a typical self-seeking fool, but then again you seem a man of quite sophisticated understanding, certainly a cut above those friends of yours.
I've travelled a bit, Mallory said slowly. I suppose it broadens a man.
Travelled where, comrade?
Mallory shrugged. Argentina? Canada? On the continent, here and there?
The Marquis glanced about them, as if looking for spies alurk in the birdbaths and chandeliers. When none showed, he seemed to relax a bit, then spoke with a renewed but quiet urgency.
Might you know the American South at all?
The Confederacy? Mallory shook his head. There's a city called Charleston in South Carolina, a charming town. It has a large community of well-born British exiles who fled the Rads, Britain's ruined cavaliers.
Very nice, Mallory grunted.
Charleston is as refined and cultured a city as any in Britain.
And you were born there, eh?
Mallory had blundered to speak this deduction aloud, for Hastings was sensitive about it and frowned. Mallory hastened on.
You must have prospered in Charleston to own a negro.
I do hope you are not an anti-slavery bigot, the Marquis said. So many Britons are. I suppose you would have me pack poor Jupiter off to one of those fever-ridden jungles in Liberia. Mallory restrained his nod of agreement. He was, in fact, an abolitionist and a supporter of Negro repatriation.
Poor Jupiter wouldn't last a day in the Liberian Empire, the Marquis insisted.
Do you know he can read and write? I myself taught him. He even reads poetry.
Your Negro reads verse?
Not verse, poesy. The great poets... John Milton. But you've never heard of him, I wager.
One of Cromwell's ministers, Mallory said readily.
Author of the Areopagitica. The Marquis nodded. He seemed pleased.
John Milton wrote an epic poem, Paradise Lost. It's a biblical story in blank verse. I'm an agnostic myself, Mallory said.
Do you know the name of William Blake? He wrote and illustrated his own books of poems.
Couldn't find a proper publisher, eh?
There are still fine poets in England. Did you ever hear of John Wilson Croker, Winthrop Mackworth Pride, Brian Waller Proctor?
I might have, Mallory said. I read a bit, penny dreadfuls mostly.
He was puzzled by the Marquis's strange interest in this arcane topic, and Mallory was worried about Tom and the others, what they must be thinking as they sat and waited for him. They might lose all patience and try something rash, and that wouldn't do. Percy Bysshe Shelley was a poet, before he led the Luddites in the time of troubles, the Marquis said. Know that Percy Shelley lives. Byron exiled him to the island of St. Helena. He remains a prisoner there, in the manse of Napoleon I. Some say he's since written whole books of plays and sonnets there.
Nonsense, Mallory said. Shelley died in prison ages ago.
He lives, the Marquis said. Not many know that.
Next you'll be saying that Charles Babbage wrote poetry, Mallory said, his nerves raw.
"'What's the point of this?' "'It's a theory of mine,' the Marquis said. "'Not so much a proper theory as a poetic intuition. "'But since studying the writings of Karl Marx, "'and, of course, the great William Collins, "'it has come to me that some dire violence "'has been done to the true and natural course "'of historical development.' "'The Marquis paused, smirked. "'But I doubt you can understand me, my poor fellow.' "'Mallory shook his head roughly.
"'I understand well enough. "'A catastrophe, you mean?'
Yes, you might well call it that.
History works by catastrophe. It's the way of the world. The only way there is, has been, or ever will be. There is no history. There is only contingency.
The Marquis's composure shattered.
You're a liar.
Mallory felt the foolish insult gall him to the quick.
Your head's full of phantoms, boy. History? You think you should have a title and estates, and I should rot in Lewis making hats. There's nothing more to it than that. You little fool, The Rads don't care tuppence for you or Marx or Collins or any of your poetic mummeries. They'll kill the lot of you here like rats in a sawdust pit."
"You're not what you seem," the Marquis said. He had gone as white as paper. "Who are you? What are you?"
Mallory tensed. The boy's eyes widened.
"A spy!"
He went for his gun. Mallory punched him full in the face. As the Marquis reeled back, Mallory caught his arm and clubbed him once, twice, across the head with a heavy barrel of the Ballester Molina. The Marquis fell bleeding. Mallory snatched up the second pistol, rose, glanced about him. The Negro stood not 5 yards away.
"I saw that," Jupiter said quietly.
Mallory was silent. He leveled both guns at the man.
"You struck my master. Have you killed him?"